They are promiscuous, mating with multiple partners. The males in the group work together to keep out strange males so they don't have to share the females. They are late risers and spend their days in activities including resting, eating, traveling, and socializing. Embracing or hugging helps to strengthen relationships within the group. What am I describing? The Muriqui monkeys of Brazil. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What can we learn about Muriquis, primates in general, and perhaps even ourselves from carefully studying a group of individual monkeys for over two decades? What has been done to protect this critically endangered species from the effects of deforestation, hunting, and other man-made threats? Can the case of the Muriqui monkeys be seen as a model for an international approach to conservation? Joining us to discuss her pioneering work studying the Muriqui monkeys of Brazil is Karen Stryer, professor of anthropology at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air. It's been a long time, some 10 years or so, I believe.
It has. Thanks for having me here again.
And I can only imagine that things have changed down there in Brazil in those areas you've been observing. How would you compare then and now?
Well, Brazil as a country has really become quite sophisticated, much more sophisticated and in many ways a lot more efficient to work in than it used to be. But I spend most of my time in the forest, and actually that's where I guess I've seen most of the changes that have been a lot of really positive ones over the years. The forest, the monkeys, the people.
Positive changes.
Well, you know, the Muriquis, as Emily said, are one of the most critically endangered primates in the world. And at this little forest in southeastern Brazil that was privately owned, it still is privately owned, but its future was really uncertain. And yet it harbored one of the world's only viable populations of this critically endangered species. And in the after we last spoke, I guess around 2001, the family that owns the forest decided to make a serious conservation commitment, and they transformed their forest into what is now a federally protected private reserve, which means that it is protected and preserved for perpetuity. And that was an enormous change, because what it means is that basically we're working in a sanctuary that, you know, the forest will persist whatever happens to the monkeys. As that, along in parallel with this conservation has been the fact that the conservation of the forest has been the increase in the Muriquis population.
Well, remind us about the Muriquis themselves. I think they used to be called something like woolly spider monkeys, right? But that's not quite the right name. And can you give us a sense of, you know, are they like baboons? Are they like chimpanzees? What are these monkeys like?
Sure. Well, the woolly spider monkey was the name that was sort of an English designation. And it was given at a time when very little was known about the Muriqui. Their closest relatives and the primates that most people would be familiar with from seeing in many zoological gardens and local zoos would be the spider monkey. And there's another closely related species called the woolly monkey. So because the Muriqui looks a little bit like the woolly monkey and the spider monkey and is a close genetic and evolutionary relative, they were referred to as the woolly spider monkey. But around in the early 1980s, and certainly over the years, I've become increasingly committed to this as well, was a lot of interest by the Brazilians in restoring the name, not to the English version, but also actually to recognize this as a unique species, which it is, and to use the Tupi Indian name for the animals, which is the Muriqui.
Does it have a meaning in that language?
Oh,
woolly spider.
No, it actually is really much more literal. It means charcoal-faced monkey. And also has a, well, that's actually the Portuguese version, Mono Cavoeira, which would mean like the charcoal monkey, partly because of its skin, its fur color and pelage. But the Muriqui also means like the gentle beasts.
And they're large?
They are the largest New World primate, with the exception of humans, of course. But they stand from head to foot about 5 feet tall, and they can weigh up to about 20 pounds, which is pretty amazing because I have a cat that weighs more than one of these monkeys, actually.
Are they spectacularly strong the way chimpanzees are?
I would not, you know, they're a really different form, and it really helps if you can put in your mind the body form of a spider monkey, the long, gracile limbs, and unlike chimpanzees, and in fact, unlike any apes, the Mauricutes have prehensile tails. And so
sure.
They use their tails as a fifth limb, and that means that when they're swinging through the trees, literally, they're going hand over hand with their tail in between, and they can use their tail to kind of propel them further along. So in their whole body form, a chimpanzee is more heavier on the upper body and the upper arms, longer leg than the lower arms, and their main mode of travel is with knuckle walking.
So. Do they have opposable thumbs?
The Mauricutes that barely have thumbs. In fact, they have these little nubs of a thumb, and part of that is probably that at one point we would think their ancestors would have had thumbs, but in part because of their locomotion, they would have been lost. And if you imagine how you would swing through the trees, hooking your hand over a branch, so they're long, their other four fingers are long and slightly curved, and that you can imagine a thumb would get jammed all the time in the way. So why it might have been lost over time.
How did you end up down in Brazil with the Mauricutes?
How I ended up with the Mauricutes? Well,
I mean, what made them an attractive group to study to begin with?
I was really interested when as an undergraduate, I'll step back a bit. When I was an undergraduate, I had this amazing opportunity to participate on an established long-term field study with yellow baboons in Kenya, the Amboseli Baboon Project, which is currently run by Jean Altman and Susan Alberts. But at that time, it was run by Jean Altman, Stuart Altman, and Glenn Hausvater. And I was invited to be on that project as a field assistant and for a graduate student. So I got interested in primates and as a result of studying baboons. But when I was in graduate school, I wanted to do a study on an animal that would let me test some of the current theories about behavior and ecology of the time. And that meant looking at a species that hadn't been studied very well. And the Mauricutes were a really great sort of model because they were known anatomically to possess kind of a mixture of traits that you would see in fruit eaters and leaf eaters. And that was a bit of simplification, but that was a big division in the way people saw social behavior adapting to ecological conditions for primates. So there were great reasons to sort of set them up as a model because anything I found out about them was going to be interesting. And this was helped by the fact that my PhD advisor had just finished narrating a film about the Mauricutes that was made by the World Wildlife Fund to expose their critically endangered status. And so my advisor, knowing what I was interested in, you know, suggested, would you look at these monkeys? And I saw the clips of the film and thought they looked really interesting. So I was able to go to Brazil in the summer of 1982. And I was with Russell Mittermeier, who at the time worked for the World Wildlife Fund, but now is the president of Conservation International. And he took me to this forest, and standing next to him, I saw my first Mauricute, and I was just like, this is it. You know, I can still remember that feeling of just like, this is it.
And what did the Mauricute think of you?
Oh, well, you know, they were unhabituated. They weren't too habituated at the time. So they saw a bunch of people in the forest, and we weren't making a lot of noise, but we also weren't, you know, we weren't anything particularly familiar. So they kind of went right past us and didn't stick around very long.
But isn't it hard to figure out a way to observe and study animals without having your actual presence get in the way or have it become an influence?
You know, people are getting, including me, are getting a lot more interested in this question now. I think in the early days, and certainly when I entered primatology, started being a primatologist You know, there are gradients of invasiveness in observation. So some researchers in the old days, primatologists or just expeditions would go out, and you know, the way you would find out what a primate had eaten was what its diet was you'd shoot the troop and examine the stomach contents. And of course, not only was that incredibly destructive and you know, arrogant at so many levels, but it also gave you very limited information.
You don't find anything else after that.
And it's just the last meal, really.
Yeah.
So
sure.
You know, it doesn't give you a lot of insights. And so the idea that, you know, to really, really understand behavior is the best way is to observe them doing what they naturally do. But, of course, in certain circumstances, and again, historically speaking, there have been traditions at other places of provisioning primates to lure them, to get them to overcome their shyness and to kind of increase the rate at which they interact with each other.
And so then you're tipping the scale too, so you're not really observing them as they would be in the wild.
Well, you wouldn't be, but you know, again, and not to defend that, because that's not the kind of research that I've done, but to be fair, if your question is not necessarily how often do they fight, but when they fight, what happens? If your question is the latter, then the best way to get a representative sample would be to provoke conflict and see what they do. And so,
nice.
You know, people could in a relatively short period of time could define what is a dominance hierarchy, and only as opposed to waiting for enough interactions to occur that you could actually see patterns in the behavior. So again, I think it's really important to be aware that there are, you know, different questions promote different methods. Nowadays, and certainly by the early 80s when I was devising my study, as well as motivated not just by my personal preference, but also by the questions I was asking and the fact that I was studying a critically endangered species where I didn't want to do anything that would alter their behavior in any way, it became a strictly observational study. But, you know, to be fair, again, they're living in a habitat, a forest fragment that has clearly been altered before I even got there. And so the concept of what is natural, you know, becomes
sure.
It becomes something that I think it's a bit misleading to claim, you know, we are watching what they do today without any kind of provisioning and without any kind of direct interference. But after 29 years of having one or more people watching them, you know, how do we know we're not there are monkeys in this group whose entire lives have been spent with a human, one or more human observers watching them.
Right.
And I should say that would be true of all long-term primate field studies. So, you know,
and do you have, I mean, have you, like when you started out, did you set up a tent? Did you have an observation booth? What, on a physical level?
Oh, you wear camouflage?
What did you actually do?
Nothing nearly as exotic as that. I was really fortunate. So this forest is situated on a privately owned farm, a ranch.
And how big is it?
The forest itself is about 2,000 hectares. So it's still pretty small. So there was a farming community that actually there's a dirt road that bisects the main valley and the forest and the coffee plantations and some pastures at one end. And, you know, there are local people, local farmers who are part of this farming community walk up and down this road all day long. So it's not like I was living in the middle of nowhere. The owner of the forest and the farm, Senor Feliciano, who died about 11 years ago, he donated one of the abandoned houses at the edge of the forest to be used as a research house. And we've expanded it and modified it in certain ways over the years, but we're still living in the same original structure. And so originally we didn't have any electricity. And in the early 80s, we were cooking on wood-burning stove from dead wood, and then we just and hot shower water was from wood, basically. So if you got home late and the fire had gone out, you had to wait about an hour and a half before there'd be enough hot water if you wanted to take a hot shower. And then in the early 90s, they brought some electricity in, and then my students actually just emailed me for the first time 2 days
wow.
ago.
So you're not exactly out there alone.
Well, it takes a long time to get there, and that's probably a really good thing because it keeps the visitors manageable. Although I should say that one of the important things that we support at the site is controlled ecotourism, which is an income source.
So can you tell us about Moriki society, you know, sort of the fundamentals before we get into maybe the then and now?
So what struck me, what really stands out and distinguishes Morikis from other primates, and this was true in the early 1980s and it's still true today, is their incredible peacefulness. So they live in a society with groups with multi-males and multi-females and their kids. And rates of aggression, fights, are really low. We have tried everything short of feeding them, short of provoking fights, just wait every year and add up the data in every possible way to see if there's any detectable dominance hierarchy. And we cannot find them. These animals really, and that would hold among males, among females, and between males and females.
You mean there's no head monkey, no alpha male?
There is no evidence, no consistent behavioral evidence of that. And I think what was striking was that in most primate societies, males compete with one another. They vie for dominance. Dominance usually translates into higher reproductive success. And females also in most primates compete with each other, and dominant females get more food. And having more food, being well nourished as a female, means, you know, higher reproductive success. So
yes.
The behaviors that promote this kind of competition are reinforced. And in many primate societies, males are larger than females and therefore also have advantages over females in terms of body size and body weight and often canine size. And that means that males can also coerce or intimidate females. The Morikis are great in that regard because their males and females are the same size. And so there's none of these hierarchical relationships. I mean, they really are living in an egalitarian society, and probably in that respect, you know, it's an admirable one that I think humans could learn from. So that really stands out. Where's the aggression? Where's the hierarchy? That they're just so peaceful.
And what about the promiscuity?
Well, the promiscuity enters into it, and of course, you know, we can't ask them what they think about this, but we can kind of construct plausible scenarios if you think about it from the point of view that females have a lot of choice over who they mate with, and maybe there's not that much of a difference to them which males are the fathers. Maybe they just want to make sure they get pregnant during the season of the year when they actually have the best food sources and are most likely to survive.
Oh, they're just as likely to be impregnated by, there must be the occasional undesirable substandard male.
Yeah, and maybe those males don't get to do it, but how would we don't have any way of measuring that.
What their criteria are for selecting.
From our perspective, uh-huh. The females, there's some preferences, you know, some males copulate more often than other males, and some females, you know, seem to hang around particular males more often. And the fact that there's some level of preference, we can see sort of in the reverse, because another feature of their society is that males stay in their natal group. So the males are growing up with their fathers and their brothers for their whole lives. And the females, when they reach adolescence, they leave the group that they were born in. So they go into a group without their mothers or their fathers. So these males are all really closely related to one another. And the males are also in the group, and because they reach sexual maturity when they're between 5 and 10, and the females, their mothers are still alive, yet they don't mate with their mothers. So there's preference in an avoidance way as opposed to preference. But we can't detect any consistent patterns. They may be there, and they may be subtle, and they may change from year to year, but my students and I have not been able to find anything consistent over that. So that creates this opportunity for males to basically keep track of each other, keep track of the females, and when a female is in estrus and sexually receptive and ovulating, the males can kind of line up. Sometimes females do tend to spend more time with particular males than others, and other times they'll mate with several males in close succession.
How well do you get to know individuals within the group? I mean, do you give them...
Pretty well, apparently.
No, I meant you as an observant. I mean, do you give them names? Do you observe sort of idiosyncratic personalities almost that some of them have?
You know, we do give them names, and the names are, I would guess you could say the original generation of names are the ones that I assigned them, and I did watch them as individuals, and they all have individual features, and that's another thing we were talking earlier about different levels of invasiveness, and, you know, with the Murakis, again, some people have to trap or mark their animals in some ways. The Murakis have very distinct faces and skin color and ear shapes and nose shapes and genital patterns, pigmentation. And so we can recognize them as individuals. And the first generation, I watched them until I could recognize them, and then I gave them names based on people they reminded me of, either physically or behaviorally.
Not people in the field with you, I trust.
No, and my initial work there, I was working with an assistant, but I was otherwise collecting the data myself. As the study has grown and the questions have kind of blossomed, you know, there's so many more questions we can ask now. I've had for many years now, have had teams each year of Brazilian students too who are with them. And the big part, in fact, I just got back from Brazil where we were doing the annual transition of training, where now in the beginning it was much easier. There, I had 23 animals to recognize in one group, and I was only studying one group. There was a second group with about that many animals. And now we're monitoring the entire population, which has grown to more than 300. And my students know each one of them. And we give them names to tell them apart, and we have a naming system so that if you're in the know, then all you need to do is say two names and people can figure out whether they're part of the same metro line or not and what group they're in. So it's as much to keep track of them and sort of shorthand as it is for anything like anthropomorphic. And nowadays with so many monkeys, we don't really wait to see what they're like. We name them as soon as they're born, and we can see whether they're males or females and based on who their mother is and the names that have already been used.
You must have, or it must be tempting at least, to assign some linguistic value to some of their utterances.
I had a graduate student from University of Wisconsin who did her PhD on their vocal communication. And before her, and in fact, the first Brazilian student who did research with this group who I trained who's now a professor at a Brazilian university, was her Brazilian sponsor, and he had also done his PhD on vocal communication. So we're learning a little bit about what they say. You know, they have these amazing vocalizations. Their main, most distinctive vocalization is like a horse's whinny. You know, it's very much
not what you'd expect.
And Luisa Arnedo, my student, discovered that they use these. This particular call is one that the males give more often than the females, and it draws animals to them. So
Why would they want to draw animals to them?
Well, if you want to know where everyone is.
Oh, it draws other monkeys to them, you mean?
Yeah.
Kind of like a gathering of the clan.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's really interesting. Yeah.
More on the Muriqui monkeys of Brazil when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Karen Stryer, and we're talking about conservation of the Muriqui monkeys of Brazil. What made them critically endangered? Was it the loss of the forest? Was it hunting? You know, what was the biggest danger to this species?
That's a really important question, Emily, because sometimes you need to know what causes the animals to get endangered before you can really figure out how to prevent those activities from continuing. The Muriquis in this region of Brazil have been so threatened largely as a result of habitat loss. This is a really productive farming region, and it was also in the part of Brazil that was explored inward for the mining industry as well, and railroads built in inland. So beginning in about the 1800s, the forest was just carved up. And what's left in this region, the state of Minas Gerais, Espírito Santo, are really, with the exception of a few fairly large federally or state-protected forests, are just fragments of what private people have protected, either because they love the forest or recognized its importance as a watershed for their crops and their cattle. And so we really are picking up on what was left over after a lot of growth and expansion and development, long before anybody was thinking about conservation or the idea that resources may be animals and plants may go extinct and there might be any need to conserve them.
Do you have a sense of what the optimum number of monkeys is? I mean, in Wisconsin we see, we bring back the wolf and all that. And now somebody's saying, well, we have too many. There's got to be a limit. 500 is too many. It should be more like 350. And you have 300 of these Muriqui monkeys now in a fairly limited number of forest acreage. Is that too many, or what's the ceiling?
The conflicts for different species are so different. So I think in the case of the wolves, when we say we have too many, it has to do with the fact that they're having so many conflicts with humans. And it's really important to think about not just the species, but how they interact or with their placement in a landscape that in Wisconsin includes humans. For the Muriquis in Brazil, their landscape also includes humans. Fortunately, they're not carnivores, so they don't represent agricultural problems to farmers or any kind of agriculture or livestock. The biggest concern is, so people pretty much leave them alone. And I should say, too, in this part of Brazil, there isn't currently and maybe hasn't been for a long time, maybe never was, much of a need to hunt to feed your family, which is another real problem for a lot of animals around the world when there's real necessity for food.
And hunting monkeys, you mean?
Yeah.
For food.
So with the Muriquis in this region, there's a relatively affluent farming community and their alternative sources of food. The Muriquis' biggest problem is forest. And you asked if 300 Muriquis is enough. Well, conservation biologists have a lot of mathematical models, and we can some people would argue that it used to be thought that might be enough, and now I think very few people would consider 300 animals of any species to be enough.
Because of the gene pool?
Well, the gene pool, and even in a case like the Muriquis where they've obviously, the population has recovered enormously, and in less than 30 years it's gone from fewer than 50 animals, between 40 and 50 in the beginning, divided between two groups, to more than 300. So the population has been growing with alongside the conservation efforts. But I think now we're at a point where the population is getting very close to what the carrying capacity of this small forest can support. And that might then start to curtail population growth unless we can increase the size of the forest. But you mentioned genetics as a concern about small populations, and that's always in the background. But there is another concern, which is what we call demographic stochasticity, or like random demographic events. Like what happens if just randomly there's a couple of generations or a couple of birth seasons where 90% of the babies born are males? When those kids grow up, there are going to be a lot more males in the population than females. And that has impacts on how fast the population can grow, because it's really limited. Its population growth is constrained by the rate of female reproduction. So you can get population declines and even crashes as a result of not only genetic problems, but also demographic, random demographic events. And in any small population, both because of population size and because of maybe a lot of genetic similarity between individuals, they're also going to be vulnerable to disease and epidemics. So you think about any kind of sickness or illness or catastrophic event, a severe drought that lasted a couple of years. It's something we worry a lot about now because of climate change. And where we might be expecting to see an increase in what people call, you know, extreme climate temperature and climate events. And you might expect in any natural ecosystem a lot of animals will die. But if you start with a big population and a lot of animals die, then you can start over when the catastrophe is passed.
Safety net kind of.
You start with a small population, then the population can be reduced so much that the same percentage of animals, but if there's fewer to start with and there's fewer to survive, and that then it goes what's considered to be below the recovery point. And that's why, you know, we do worry about the minimal viable size of a population.
Well, I have a question for you. What if you are in an argument, let's say, with ranchers or with a logging company, and they're wanting to destroy the forest, and say, so what if it threatens these monkeys? There's other species. Who cares about the murrikees? How would you sort of defend, passionately, I assume, how would you defend the importance of the survival of this one species in this one place?
Well, I want to answer this question with a comparison, and this happened actually many years ago when I was working in another forest. I've worked in this main forest in Minas Gerais for my entire study, but there was a period of time when I had another project in parallel with it. And while I was involved in this other project in the state of São Paulo, in a protected, it was a state forest, it was protected, so there were guards and patrols. Actually, it was during a World Cup game. I guess some hunters thought that the guards would be busy watching TV, and they went into the forest and did some illegal hunting. And at the end of their hunt, where they had caught a lot of wildlife, including some murrikees, one of the hunters got lost. It was getting dark, and fired his gun, and the guards heard the gun and were able to apprehend him. So the owner, the director of that park asked me. They were in a position where they could fine the hunter for the value. And he wanted to know. He was trying to do, I think, a really interesting calculation. How much is a murrikee worth?
Hmm.
And he had come up with this idea that how much would it cost to keep a murrikee in captivity and feed it and give it health care and so on. And that would be the price. And then, you know, we worked out how long they could live and how many babies they could have. And before you know it, it was an impossible sum to assign to anybody. So they found another solution to that problem. In your question, how would you defend the survival of a particular species? Well, I would say, first of all, we don't know yet which species are the ones that we need to prioritize for conservation and how we would make those criteria judgment calls. So for that matter, I think at some level, the goal is to preserve as much of biodiversity as we possibly can. In the case of the murrikees, you know, I would make a personal, my view, they're unusual in many levels, not just the behavior, which we talked about a little bit, and not just the fact that they've already been pushed to the, you know, almost to the brink of extinction. And the fact that in just 30 years, which sounds like a long time, but it's not really a long time. They've shown the capacity to make such a remarkable recovery that it seems to me that we still have a lot we could learn from them, maybe not only about behavior, but about surviving in a changing world. And I think that those are really valuable attributes to make it possible. The Moerkies in particular, you know, also serve as a model for other conservation problems. And in that sense, then saving them can help us to save other species as well.
What were the conservation steps that enabled them to sextuple their numbers in a fairly short period of time?
I've never known how to say that. That's good. Thanks. I always say increase sixfold. Well, you know, this is a really special case. And I would actually, I suspect that all the cases I'm familiar with around the world with primates are special cases, each one of them. The fortunate part of the Moerke story is that it happened in Brazil, in a country where there was already a lot of public concern and a strong university system and a lot of people involved in conservation and concerned with biodiversity.
So awareness and motivation.
When I stepped into a system that people were already interested about saving these animals, at a place where the family had protected the forest, even though they didn't have to, and that the owner was really concerned with conservation, and his heirs, including his grandson, who is the president of the Moerke Preservation Society that administers the forest now and was responsible for turning it into a protected reserve, these people actually cared about the animals. So what did they do is they agreed to protect the forest and make a commitment and are working to try to make this reserve self-sustaining. And, you know, there are costs associated. You set aside a piece of land, but then if you want to have any research going on in it, we have to keep some trails cleared, and we have a house that we have to, my students need to have a place to sleep and so on. So there are some costs associated with running it, and you need people there to make sure that if there's a fire or if there's a problem in the forest or intruders, they can be caught. And so that costs, you know, that's an issue.
So maintenance, but in terms of, we're not talking about like reforestation or restoring habitat so much as preserving?
That's a big goal too because in fact, the Moerkies have helped make the case for the need to expand the forest because while this piece of forest is protected, there are smaller plots of forest also owned by neighboring landowners. And a big initiative now in this region is to create what's known as a forest corridor, linking these little patches of forest together. And that involves getting all the different landowners to buy in to the fact that they could afford to set aside some of their land. The land that is in between those forest fragments, would they donate a little piece of land where trees could be planted, and that when those trees grew, they would connect the forest, and that would provide like a pathway for animals that are dependent on forest to move from each, to move between these different fragments. So this is an initiative that's being spearheaded right now by Conservation International in Brazil and by the NGO that administers the reserve, the Preserve Moerke. And my students and I have been involved in it to the extent that we are, some of my students independently have gone and done projects looking at assessing the fragments. And in fact, that was an important discovery because, you know, we keep track of all the animals in our population. And when females reach dispersal age, about 6 or 7 years of old, they leave their groups and we follow them now into the other groups in the forest. But sometimes they disappear. And if they're gone for long enough, we just assume they were dead. Except that my students found 4 of them living in these fragments that the only way you could get to was to walk across
open land.
And we knew they come to the ground and we knew they cross path, you know, parts in the forest that don't have any vegetation. But what this was so exciting and also alarming. And the excitement was that to see them colonizing, you know, this is how we go to the moon, you know, and here's these monkeys colonizing this forest that they had to cross through barren pasture where there could be dogs or predators or anything to get to another forest. It's so amazing. And yet it was also alarming because what it told us is that these females maybe are feeling the pressure of overcrowding in this forest and that they're trying to colonize a new place. They're looking for new groups to join. And so far we haven't found any other groups of murkies in these forests. But the fact that the monkeys perceive them as being places where they can find enough food means that if we can connect them and provide a safer pathway and also get these forests that are currently owned by other people into the part of the protected reserve, then we basically are increasing this forest enormously. And the long-term goal, and this is, again, something that I'm involved with at a collaborative level, but it's being spearheaded by Conservation International in Brazil, is connecting this patch of forest that has this population of murkies with another patch of forest.
Right, that diversity.
That has murkies, and, you know, that's a long-term project. Mm-hmm. But it's after seeing this population grow so much in 30 years, almost 30 years, I think anything is possible. And I think it is worth noting that, you know, people, conservation to a lot of people, I know this is true with a lot of my students, you know, you feel a bit helpless. It's such a big problem. How do you begin to solve it? And maybe this gets back a little bit to your earlier question, Emily. You know, maybe it is the case of taking one species at a time. You can really do something.
Kind of show the way for other species.
Well,
I'm sort of wondering if they don't end up, some of them, living in Sao Paulo. You know, how adaptable are they?
Well, they'd have to cross a lot of not just open land, but a lot of urban land as well to get there.
And what are their natural predators?
Well, their natural predators would probably be all the large cats. And in fact, we have found the little part of a finger of one of our babies, whose name was Janie, in the scat of an ocelot. So we know that they still get taken by predators, even in this forest. But there would be in cats as big as pumas, or not in this site, but in some other sites, maybe jaguars that still inhabit them. We don't have any jaguars. It's probably too small of a forest.
I want to look a little more closely at the family structure of these Moriki monkeys in Brazil when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Karen Stryer, who is filling us in about this fascinating population of monkeys in Brazil, the Moriki monkeys that she's been studying, well, really for almost 30 years now, and observing close hand and discovering some fascinating things about what they do and their mobility, too. But I did want to get back to some questions about this family structure, since you've indicated, Karen, that there may be several mates for any given female.
Mm-hmm.
And should we assume from that paternity doesn't have a lot to do with childcare?
Well, we know from behavioral data that the males don't harm the infants at all. And so a characteristic of some other primates where males are highly competitive, and you see infanticide, in this case, the males are pretty calm. Now, it's true that in an early study we did on adult male and infant interactions, they were very rare, and the infants almost always initiated them, and the males, and they were very short, like 30 seconds, like an infant would leave its mother's body and, you know, maybe ramble on over to a male that might be sitting on a branch, resting on a branch nearby, and the male would kind of like kind of get tense and back off, and as if you know, he was terrified of this little creature that was crawling all that was starting to crawl onto him. Now we've begun to see the males being a little bit more interactive with the kids, and the kids still initiate the interactions, but the adult males now, what's changed is the duration of the interactions. It's almost as if the males are getting more confident being around kids, and this may be because some of them are the older brothers of the babies, and some of them, and it may just be that there's so many more babies in the group now relative to the adults that they're more familiar with having little kids around than in the old days when the population was so much smaller and there weren't very many kids at any given time.
And how long do these monkeys live, and how do they handle the aging process or illness, like if you have a monkey that is not well?
Well, they live a long time. So I know some of the animals that were babies, you know, newborn, just a few months old when I first saw them in 1982, are still alive. So that would put them 82, 29 years later. You know, they're getting up there and into they're at least 29 years old. Animals that were already adult, and we still have some of the females that were carrying babies, and we know that the youngest age we have for any female with a baby who her first birth at when she was a little over 7 years. So even if, and that's a young age, it's usually closer to 10 for the females. If those females from 1982 were only 7 years old, then they're in their mid-30s now, and some of them are still nursing new babies. They're still reproductively active. So they live a long time. How they deal with aging? Well, when I was in my 20s, just like most of my students are now, I could run up those trails without panting and, you know, right next alongside to the monkeys. Now I'm kind of huffing up the trails, and sometimes I'll look up and they'll be, you know, there's a big group now and they're all spread out, and my students are way up ahead of me with the front of the group, and I'm back, and who's back there with me? The old females. We're all kind of laboring up the hill at our own pace, slow and steady. We have seen a lot of animals deal with injuries, you know, falls out of the trees are not as uncommon. You think, oh, they're so adapted to be in the trees. They're actually, they fall out of the trees. And we have seen animals that have broken bones, broken limbs, either broken arms or broken legs, and visibly you can see the bones sticking out. And amazingly, some of them have survived, you know, clearly recovered, and after not using an arm or a leg for a while, they then go on to live successful, long lives, and others seem to recover and then they subsequently die. It's really heartbreaking when you see an animal that you know is injured or sick and you don't know if it's going to make it. We have a
you can't do anything for it.
Well, you know, we intervened once in the early 90s. My students, I was actually teaching here in Madison, and my students, you know, one of them went into town to call me midday. These are all Brazilian students, and to say that they had found a baby monkey in the, you know, by herself in the forest, and the group had moved on. And so there were three students there at the time, and one of them stayed with the rest of the group. One of them stayed with the baby monkey, and the other one got our old VW Beetle and drove 26, you know, whatever it was at the time, 26 kilometers into town to call me. Or I guess he went to the other town, it's only 12 kilometers away, to find out what they should do. And, you know, the options really were let it die or try to get it to a primate center where it could be cared for.
Or try to get it back to the group.
Or try to give it back to its mother. And in this case, I made the call that, well, it was only 4 months old, and it had already been. They found it first thing in the morning, and it was cold to the touch, and it was the first time that we'd ever touched, the first and only time we'd touched one of these monkeys. And they already had their hands on it, so I said, well, it's probably not going to make it to the primate center, and even if it made it there at that age, it would need constant care, and that's a lot of burden to put on an already stretched primate center. And they'd already picked it up. And the student who'd gone to be with the other group knew whose baby it was.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, we can recognize all of them. So we agreed that they would take the baby back to the house and only one student would handle it. And they gave it a little bit of mashed milk and bananas and or mashed milk and apples and kept it warm and dry. And, you know, we've got pictures to show. It's just, you know, showed up this limp little thing with cloudy eyes. And within a few hours, it was just, you know, like any little creature, like, you know, a kitten or a puppy, or just, you know, exploring its world. And then the next morning, I said, you know, wrap it up in a blanket and, again, minimize the number of people contacting it. Put in a blanket underneath the tree that its mom is in, and then everyone get out of view. So they did that, and baby crawled out and gave a little peep, and like its mother was there in instance, and she called to it, and then the baby called to it, and, you know, right away then the baby was back on its mom nursing. And that female, whose name was Princesa, like princess in Portuguese, is now a mother of several kids herself. So she, you know, we saved that monkey. And I was criticized, actually, for intervening and, you know. And
oh, that's a tough call.
It's still a fascinating experiment, though, meaning if you look at it in quantitative terms.
In that case, I think we did the right thing in that instance. More recently, you know, we had an opportunity to there was another. This was a baby that was still at its umbilical cord, and it's probably what happened is its mother dropped it during the birth or it fell, and we let that one die. We didn't really know what
to
do.
Too young to save.
Well, and I think at some point too, the degree to which we begin to interfere, it's not just about altering the research, but it's also about interfering in natural selection, and, you know, we're saving animals that would have died. So I think if our presence or our research effort had been responsible for these separations of mothers, maybe the burden, the difficulty of that decision would have been greater than it was when it had nothing to do with us. You know, these were in both cases, these were animals that we came across. We now know right now there's a female that we think is quite injured and likely to die, and it's, you know, we hope she's dead. She dies quickly because we can't intervene.
And do you see emotions observed among the monkeys? You hear sometimes, for example, of elephants displaying grief and, you know, any of us with pets have observed jealousy and just, you know, what kind of emotions?
So, you know, something that we've seen on a few occasions and the footage, we have video footage of it that my students have taken in photographs, is heart-wrenching of mothers carrying around babies that died of natural causes for days until, I mean, then these are animals that need their arms to move through the trees, and usually the babies can clutch the mothers themselves. And these are mothers that are completely in unnatural postures, doing everything they can, struggling to keep up with the group while they secure this limp baby's foot. And, you know, you can see the baby over days and days is falling apart, literally, and the mother still won't let it go. So what is she thinking or feeling? We have no idea. Does that resonate with us about some kind of emotion? It does. But, you know, maybe it's all instinct. We don't know. But, you know, that gets me back to your question, why conserve the monkey? Isn't there some level at which understanding the things that we can connect, that we see about ourselves in another species, isn't that something worth protecting? I mean, to me, that's ultimately where the answer is.
And we'll leave the question right there. Good way to end an hour. With Karen Stryer. Thanks for filling us in about some of your latest observations about the Moriqui monkeys in Brazil.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to have this opportunity.
Don't wait another 10 years to come back. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.